Ethos New York Knicks podcast. Andre Gallagher. Game one victory in the books. Get excited. Appreciate the victory. We know it's only one game. Everybody worth their salt knows it's only one game. Again, the Knicks had to win. They won it. It was tough sledding, but they got it done. Move on. Move on. Game two tonight. Talk about how I came into this game. I told you I thought they would win this game by 15 plus points. Boy, I missed the boat on that. And what I told you was, if they won it by 15 plus points, it would give me a good idea that I had a good feel for the series. So I do not. I do not have a good feel for the series. What you saw was the sum of all fears when it came to Jalen Brunson and this team. They played him well. They played him better than they played him even before. They added a whole new wrinkle, blocking his shot from behind. And he never figured it out. And I don't know if we've ever seen Jalen never figure it out in a game. You know, I knew Oubre played him well, played him tight. But this was even tighter than the previous matchups. We've never seen, Jalen's had bad games, but I've never seen him get locked up. Like even, you know, you have a bad game, you're not shooting well, you know, you're not making your shots. He looked locked up. I was telling a friend of mine, if Jalen comes out in this game and he is off the charts, like that man's going to be like Michael Jordan to me. If he comes out and he adjusts and he has a big game tonight, I'm not even expecting him to shoot 50% from the field like he typically does. I'm saying if he's even shooting 45, 46%, you know, making his threes, I would be impressed. Because the way the Sixers were playing him, it wasn't just Oubre who was playing him well. Even Maxey was playing him well. Maxey doesn't even play defense like that. They were lining him up. They knew what shots he was going for. They waited for his release point, and they blocked that shot. That's elite defense right there. This is one of those things I try to teach my sons and I come across young players. When you're playing defense, to try to get an idea of where the release point and the timing of that person's shot is, and then you can test based on where that person releases from. I used to block a lot of jump shots that way when I used to play. And I try to tell young players, that's what you do. Look, where does this guy release from? What's the timing of his shot? You might have more time to get there than you think. And you saw Maxey, he blocked Brunson at least twice in the game. And it was all coming from behind. It was all coming, if he had to chase him around the screen, he rose up to shoot. You don't know if Jalen's going to shoot the three or if he's going to keep going. He had the timing down every single time, and you got to give him credit for it. You just do. You got to give him credit for it. Oubre did exactly what I thought he would do. He was even better. He absorbed contact from Jalen. He didn't even put Oubre to work the way you normally would because everybody was playing Jalen well. You know, Batum dropped the ball on him a couple times. But outside of that, everybody was playing Jalen well. You didn't even have to keep Oubre on him the whole game. But luckily for the Knicks, you had other guys step up. You had Deuce McBride have another awesome game. Deuce McBride, homegrown Knick, molded by Tibbs. People thought he wasn't good. People tried to say Knicks would get rid of him. I talked about the Donovan Mitchell trade talk from a couple summers ago and how everybody wanted to throw all of these names of guys they never heard of in the deal. The value the Knicks have in their young players is different than the value these other teams have in those young players. That doesn't make the Knicks unique. That's true for a lot of teams. But the Knicks, in their mind, were sending out more value than the general perception of those players would suggest. And they knew it. And they had to draw the line somewhere. And you see what this kid is doing in a big spot when the Knicks desperately needed him. He came out, first of all, he guarded Maxey extremely well. And he comes out and he's not even hitting. It's not like they're leaving him wide open. I hate that. When you hear people, you know, analyze the game, sometimes they call shots open shots. And it's like, What do you want the guy to do? Like, they gotta rotate. He's not standing directly in front of him. He's running at him. But the first shot that Deuce took, who was it? Buddy Hield he contested that as almost as well as you can expect. Now, maybe the angles on the TV are a little bit different, but he's taking tough shots. Don't care what anyone says, they're not leaving him wide open. The guy they were leaving wide open, and the guy I told you had to have a good series, had to make the 76ers pay for not guarding him, and that was Josh Hart. And it was a little up and down during the game, but he finished strong with some hero moments down the stretch. Those were hero moments from Josh Hart. Deuce had hero moments in the first half. Josh had hero moments at the end of the game. The Knicks had nothing going on offense. They didn't know where they were going. They didn't know what they were doing. On that lat, on the only time the Knicks looked like they knew what they were doing was on the OG three. On the three OG had, I think Rit Holzman broke this whole sequence down on Twitter. Go check it out. He talked about throughout the game, how the 76ers played the Knicks pick and roll. Was like a chess match going back and forth between Tibbs and Nurse. And it ended with the Knicks using horns, which is basically setting two screens up top so that Embiid had to come up. Because what Embiid started doing is he started sending Josh Hart's man up to go guard the screen so he can stay in the paint. And he didn't have to guard Josh Hart. And I told a friend of mine coming into the series, the Knicks had to make their corner threes this series because Joel Embiid wasn't going to go chase anybody out of the corner, and it was probably going to be Hart, right? So Joel is sending anybody who's guarding Hart up to guard the screen. So that might be a Batum or an Oubre or whoever. And then he just stays on Hart. So if Hart's not going to hit his outside shot, it's like, what do you get, right? So Hart made some pretty clutch. He made clutch shots at the end of this game, but the Knicks didn't have a whole lot going on. Like the offense was stymied. Now you assume that those adjustments are going to be made coming into this game. But Josh Hart, if he's not going to hit his outside shots, the whole drive into the paint with Embiid standing there, it doesn't, it's not going to work the same. And I told you, Josh Hart doing that against disciplined defenders, it doesn't work the same. The 76ers, they're not going to all collapse to the paint because Josh Hart drives 2 feet towards the lane. They're not all going to leave shooters. And what Josh Hart typically depends on is for everybody to collapse when he drives, and then he finds a relocating shooter on the perimeter. Well, the 76ers are not going to do that. And I've seen a bunch of good teams stop doing that. They're making you make a play. You got to shoot it. Either you're going to shoot the three or you're going to shoot it in the paint. You got to shoot it. And Embiid is like, go ahead and shoot that three. Right? Now, you saw that the 76ers were leaving him open, but they gave him a late contest. On a lot of those that like double clutch three that Josh hit, where Lowry looked like Lowry actually got a finger on the ball on the way up, that they were comfortable leaving him open for that shot. But Kelly Oubre came and contested one of the other threes. They're giving him a soft contest. They want him to take that shot. They want him to take that shot. So as long as he's going to be out there, he's got to make these teams pay. And he talked about it in the post game. Nurse has not guarded him the last two matchups they played. He's just not guarding Josh Hart on the perimeter. He's willing to live with whatever Josh Hart does on offense. And I've talked about this all year, not necessarily about Josh Hart, even though, I have mentioned it. But I talked about it a lot when it came to RJ Barrett. When you have RJ Barrett and Mitchell Robinson on the floor, is that was the talk at the time. There's nowhere to go. There's nowhere to go. Good defensive teams are like, hey, Mitchell Robinson is not a threat. He's standing here in the front of the paint. He's not relocating. He's not creating passing lanes. He's not doing anything we got to worry about. He's not dunking. He's not doing anything. And then RJ Barrett is an inconsistent shooter. We don't care what he does. So now you got two extra defenders in the paint at all times. At least with Julius Randle, even though his 3-point shooting numbers weren't tremendous, people guarded him at the 3-point line. They might have sagged off him a little bit, but not like RJ, right? So it would kill the Knicks offense. So if the Knicks could just have somebody who can hit that outside shot, it opens things up. And one of the reasons why the Knicks are so much better offensively with Hartenstein is because Hartenstein was more of a threat offensively in a myriad of ways. It opens the offense up. Well, what teams were doing with Josh Hart is they would necessarily leave him open, or not to say that they wouldn't leave him open, but they would close out to him. So he would attack the closeout and then break the defense down further. So there's no, there are like maybe a handful of teams that, I don't know, have the discipline or the preparation to come and play the Knicks and not guard Josh Hart at the three-point line. And the other thing that he does is he closes out. When you close out, he almost always drives in the middle, right? Teams would let him get away with it all the time. The fact that Josh Hart is telling you that, okay, Nick Nurse just left me open the last two games, that tells you that most teams do not just leave him open. All right, so good defensive teams that do that, they stymie the Knicks offense unless Josh Hart's going to make them pay. Now, Josh Hart said he was taking threes all week last week in preparation. Well, man, what you been doing all year? Can I just say that? What you been doing all year? I love Josh Hart. But come on, don't tell me you just been shooting all week this week. Maybe he's just saying that to put it in the media to let the 76ers know they better step up. Because I know he worked on his shot during the All-Star break too. And that's one positive way to look at it, because after the All-Star break, he shot almost 50% from the field for like a couple weeks. Not the field, the three. So maybe you get those same results. Now, maybe if he concentrates on his shot, you know, you get a little stretch of hot shooting from him like you did in the All-Star at the All-Star break. But what you doing all year? I have to assume that you're working on your shot all year, putting up shots all year, or is some of that talk about you not being a great practice player, does that kind of bleed into you working on that aspect of the game? I don't want to make this a criticize Josh Hart thing, because I love Josh Hart. You can add him to the list of Knicks across my lifetime that if they got traded, or, you know, for whatever reason they weren't on the team anymore, I would actually be saddened by it. Because to me, he is a true Knick through and through. You see, he braided his hair, put the NY logo on top of his head like Anthony Mason back in the day. He used to carve it into his haircuts. He's a true Knick. He embodies what the Knick cultures should be, or was when I was growing up. That said, I know that shooting sometimes is psychological and is real easy to say, hey, just shoot the ball, just practice, 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 and you'll get better. If that was the case, then everybody would be shooting 50% from the field, right, from the three. Not some people just don't get better because their shot isn't, you know, that shot's not quite right, or, you know, sometimes it's your eyesight. Lowest of keys. Sometimes it's your eyesight. You need that little LASIK surgery. There's been a couple players who got LASIK and started shooting the ball better. You know, sometimes, you know, you just, it's just not the, it's not your strong suit. But in order for the Knicks to get to the promised land, he can't be out there not making that shot. He's on the floor too much. And the Knicks offense is too paint centric to have a guy who's just not being guarded. And Embiid is too good of a defensive player to just have him able to just stand in the paint and not have to guard anybody. And you have to expect the Knicks to continue to make offensive adjustments that keep Embiid, get Embiid out of the paint, because they did it at the end of the game. You know, so listen, this is going to be a chess match. You know, I know a lot of people don't like Tibbs. I make the point to say that Tibbs and his staff, they've been really good this year with adjustments. A lot of times coming out of halftime with some great adjustments that have turned some games around. Nick Nurse is known for being a crafty coach when it comes to these things, and he has a personnel defensively, for the most part, to do a lot of things to get in the way of the Knicks, who kind of do struggle to score. You also got a great game from Bogdanovich, who came in like a hero, you know, unafraid, making his shots. It's invaluable. And you hear a lot of talk with people saying, hey, you're not going to get this Deuce game every game. You're not going to get this Josh 4-of-8 from 3 every game. You're not going to get Bogdanovich, you know, scoring at will the way they did. But you're also likely to not get Brunson playing as poorly as he did. Dante not being as effective as he could be. You're not always going to get that. Hartenstein wasn't as effective as he could be. Now, on that, Mitchell Robinson, and I'll admit it. I'll go on the record right now and admit it to you. I was critical of Mitchell Robinson in the middle of this game. I was criticizing him because I can see his I can see that the game, it was mostly when Paul Reed was in the game. I could see that there was a speed and quickness, a quick twitch that it looked like the Knicks needed, especially in that third quarter, I think that's what it was, that he wasn't ready for. And it was scaring me as a prospect going forward, because it was like there's going to be some hustle plays that need to be made, some chase downs, chase loose balls that need to be chased down. He doesn't look like he's getting to some rebounds that he doesn't look like he's going to have the lift to get. And just no sooner than he's, and that's kind of like historically how I feel about Mitch sometimes since the injury is he's not gonna be as versatile defensively, as quick defensively, as precious. And I thought, especially with Paul Reed in the game, I thought they were gonna need some more quickness, some more versatility defensively. You saw a lot of plays at the front of the rim. Maxey was eaten at the front of the rim, and I know a lot of that had to do with Embiid sitting on the perimeter. But somebody who is playing with a lot of energy and a lot of hustle and a lot of quick twitch, they're going to chase that down. They're going to chase people down at the front of the rim, even if Embiid is out there, and just you're hoping that your teammates rotate out and get back out to him. On some of those plays, Mitchell leaves 3-point shooters and he shouldn't. And in some of those plays, it's like, yeah, man, they need you to be help at the rim right now. So there's a balancing act there that I thought he was struggling with, and then just like that, the man turned it on. It's like you press a button with me, and he gets locked in. And you heard Hartenstein say it after the game: the most important thing with Mitch Robinson is being locked in. When he's locked in and engaged, he's an entirely different player. When he's not locked in, I can see it, and it's like he's always a step slow. But he got locked in at some point in that second half, boy. And he had made some plays in the first half too, but it seemed like it was taking him a while to get going. But when the way he played Embiid, bro, I mean, he had some great offensive rebounds. Remember, there were some games right before the end of the season where most of the games, Mitch Robinson was having like one rebound. He had like one rebound. So I was scared of the Mitchell Robinson minutes. I think I talked about it coming into the game. Boy, did this guy turn it on. He turned it on. And he took that Embiid challenge and he stepped right up to it. And I know Embiid hurt himself trying to be cute, dunking on people, throwing it off the backboard. My level of sympathy goes down when you try to do silly nonsense in the game and you hurt yourself. You already know that you're hurt. Nobody wants to see Embiid hurt, but they're going out there trying to throw the ball off the backboard, man. The reason why Embiid doesn't dunk is because he doesn't want to hurt his knee. And then he tries something crazy like that. Anyway. I know he was a little hampered in the second half, but he was still out there. He's still a factor, and Mitchell had to step up and he had to make plays, and he did it. And he did it. And give him credit, because I have not been high on Mitchell Robinson all year. Not to dismiss the things he does well, but I have not been high on him all year. But if there's a matchup where you need Mitchell Robinson, it's in a series where you have one of the great big men of all time. Post big men. Of all time. If they're playing any team where they have a big man who makes his bones in the paint, you need Mitchell Robinson. You need him to play big. Because Hartenstein did not play well. Some of that was, I think, a little jitters. He missed shots that he normally made. I think he was a little scared of Embiid at the front of the rim. He didn't get the pocket passes as he sometimes gets. I think he'll be better in this next game. I really do. You're seeing talk that the Sixers might start Paul Reed, so they can, be more of a factor on the boards. I think that's an interesting move, for them. I don't think that's something that would hurt them. I think that's actually not a bad move on their part, and it might actually get them to a strong start, because now you're dealing with OG having to, keep Paul Reed off the boards. Yeah, and now you're dealing with your offensive rebound potential not being as much of a strength if they have a rebounder down there. How does that affect their second unit? I think the Knicks' second unit, as it went down in this first game, is the key to the series. It really is. Because where does Philly go? We already know what this Philly team is without Embiid. You've seen it. You already know what they are. They're not the strongest team in the world. and the Knicks, that's where the Knicks are better. Now, forget playoff struggles, just looking at what we know happened in the regular season. The Knicks at full strength with Randle, I think they're better than Philadelphia. I think statistically they were clearly better than Philadelphia. But Philadelphia without Embiid, Knicks without Randle, the Knicks are clearly better. With an OG, the Knicks are clearly better. Philly struggled, almost fell out of the play-in. But when you have Embiid and Philly, the Knicks and no Randle, and I forget all of the playoff stuff that you guys and me talk about with Randle, just looking at it objectively on paper, the Knicks are not as strong of a team. But what is the difference? The difference is Embiid. So you have to win the no Embiid, the non-Embiid minutes. You have to win them. You have to win them. Because you are, without question, the better team when he's not on the floor. So if they're going to, on top of having Embiid hampered and gimpy, and they're going to take his primary backup center and put him at power forward, maybe they create an advantage when Embiid is on the floor, but they already had an advantage when Embiid was on the floor. That, to me, the rebounding is more a factor. And I'm not saying it's not a factor when Embiid is there, but it's more a factor when Embiid is not there. Because Paul Reed is not a big, strong guy. And so he's competing with, essentially by himself, because it's not, the 76ers are not a big team by any means outside of Paul Reed and Embiid. He's competing with Mitchell Robinson, the second unit, or Hartenstein with the minutes, you know, depending on how the minutes get staggered. And he's dealing with Josh Hart and OG and all of these guys hustling on the boards. He's basically fighting for these rebounds by himself down there. That's really the bigger deal to me. It's when Embiid is not on the floor. So, yeah, they might have an advantage on the boards with Embiid and Paul Reed out there together, but they're going to have to play. They're going to have to play big minutes together, to me, to make that the deciding factor in the game. And is Paul Reed, and I think Paul Reed is a pretty good player. He can move his feet defensively. He can cover a lot of ground. He's pretty fast. You know, if he's going to be out there for big minutes, and that means you're limiting your spacing on the floor, which means doubling Embiid, rotating out to shooters, it's going to be a little bit easier. He's not going to be a strong ball handler. If he has to put the ball on the floor, look out for OG getting in the mix. You know, the spacing is going to be a little bit more condensed if Paul Reed is out there. So there might be some advantages that the Knicks can take advantage of. Now, you might not see it in the first half because it's a wrinkle. Maybe Tibbs is ready for it, maybe not. You might see it at the halftime. But I think the Knicks will adjust to it. This game, you can say this about any game too. And you can say this about every game in the series, really. You really can. But when you've been watching, and now, you know, some younger listeners, I understand, you know, perspectives get a little skewed when you're listening to so many talking heads out there. But I can just tell you, going back 30, 35 years, getting a split, if you're the road team, in the first two games of the series, that's it. Teams are very comfortable with that. They're very comfortable with that. So although winning game one was a hell of a feat, you got it done, it's done, it by no means means the series is any more in your hand. Forget the percentages and all that stuff, because that stuff is heavily, you need to heavily nuance that. The percentages of the teams that win the first game is, well, how many times is it the home team? The home team typically wins the series and they have home court advantage. I mean, there's so many other factors at play. This series isn't over after one game. So what happens? How many of those series did that team win game two as well? Like, you know, don't get hung up on those percentages. Just know that the road team is very comfortable winning one game in the series. And if they win one game in the series, it doesn't matter if it was game one or game two. They won one game in the series. And also, when you're the team that has to make adjustments in the second game, it gives you a little bit of an advantage. I don't think that's the case here, because this was a close game where the Knicks had to overcome poor play. It wasn't like, they blew the doors off of the 76ers like I thought they would. They had to fight, scratch, and claw and win this game. And some would say that they won this game because Embiid got hurt. And I don't think it's definitely a factor. There's no shame coming from me because I'm not one of these people who try to act like the 76ers weren't a great team. The Knicks were playing the first round. So, yeah, they probably won this game because Embiid got hurt. Did you see how poorly Jalen Brunson shot? So my fear going into game two is not so much the schematics, because I think that Tibbs and his staff, they've done a good job, I think, all year long making adjustments. You saw Devo struggle. I think Devo's going to hit his outside shots, but they're not trying to leave him open. He attacks closeouts and he's not finishing because Embiid is there. So he needs to make something happen when he attacks closeout, because he was poor on that front in this game one, right? Josh Hart, you need a repeat performance. Another excellent game all the way around. You need a repeat performance from him. And you need a big series from him, as long as they're not going to guard him. You just bottom line, you need a repeat performance from Mitchell Robinson. Now, I think the Knicks should try to spend more time matching Mitchell Robinson with Embiid. Does that mean starting Mitchell Robinson? I think that's too ostentatious. You can't do that. Our sign has been too good all year to just take his starting job away. But I do think that maybe you pull Hartenstein earlier to match Embiid's minutes, so that you don't have to keep Mitchell in the game through the Paul Reed minutes into the Embiid minutes in the second quarter, and then have him play a longer stretch. And I'm not saying that because Mitchell Robinson is out of shape and because of his foot, but because that also keeps Hartenstein out of the game. And I think whereas Hartenstein might not have an advantage when Embiid is in the game, he has a definite advantage when he's not. So you and the Knicks are struggling to score. So you need Hartenstein and what he brings to the table. You just might not get it. I mean, we'll see this game if he adjusts, but you might not get it when Embiid is on the floor, but you can definitely get it when Paul Reed is out there. So I don't want to lose the value that Hartenstein can bring because you're trying to play Mitchell with Embiid, but Mitchell through Paul Reed and through Embiid minutes, and you're losing too much of Hartenstein. And then you end up playing Hartenstein against Embiid at the end of the second quarter because Mitchell has to come out. So I wonder what Tibbs is going to do there, trying to match those minutes up. You might see Hartenstein get pulled a little bit earlier so he can come back in the game and play against Paul Reed a little bit more. So we'll see. And it's not to say that Mitchell Robinson can't dominate the Paul Reed matchup. It's just that I know that Hartenstein can. And you might be able to get him going, get his floaters out there, get him in rhythm as well. Right? Now, the other thing is Deuce McBride, Dante. Dante's been too good for Knicks all year. For He didn't play because Deuce was good, and you're going to play the hot hand. I got no problem with it whatsoever. Deuce was too good in this game to sit him down for any reason other than he's not playing well anymore. All right. That said, Deuce McBride versus Maxey was the big matchup in this game. Maxey was scoring at will, something I didn't see happening because OG did such a good job on him in the regular season. And the Knicks in general did a good job on him in the regular season. I didn't see that happening. The reason why it was happening was because the high screen and roll, the way the Knicks were covering it, was giving Maxey some runway to get to the front of the rim. And because the center was out on the perimeter with Embiid, there was nobody at the front of the rim. And because OG was first, you had OG on Maxey, chasing him around the screens, and now he's behind him, and Max is getting to the front of the rim or getting open shots because he has to navigate Embiid screens, and Embiid is setting illegal screens half the time, and plus he's like huge. So getting around huge guys, the same thing with Joker, getting around huge guys when it comes to screens is very difficult for people. So Max is getting around these screens, he's getting all the way to the rim, and there's nobody there. So I think what they need to do, two things. They need to switch up how they were guarding a high screen and roll, and they did that. So they were able to nullify Embiid, maybe because of injury, but in the second half, they were able to nullify Embiid because they made him a scorer from the perimeter, right? But in order to get Maxey off his spot, you might need more backside help from OG instead of Josh Hart. There were a lot of plays where Maxey was coming downhill and the only help at the rim was Josh Hart, and Maxey was just scoring around him. So if OG's not going to be able to be a functional defender on Maxey because of the high screen and roll game with Embiid, then you're going to need him to be the backside guy to slow Maxey down coming to the basket. And you saw Maxey, he does a lot. To me, Maxey does a lot of the same things. He comes down and he finishes with his right hand almost every single time. He looks like he's going to go left, but he keeps coming back to his right hand, even if he's on the left side of the basket. These are kind of some of the trends, some of the what's the word I'm looking for? Tendencies that Tibbs is going to pick up on, staff is going to pick up on, the team is going to pick up on. So I think I'd be surprised, unless you're seeing the shooting from the outside, I'd be surprised if you see Maxey getting a whole lot at the rim again in this game. I'd be surprised. You know what? You got to give up something, but I'd be surprised if that's what it is. All right. I think they make Embiid score from the perimeter a little bit more. Might put guys in foul trouble a little bit more. But I think they make him more of a scorer from out there. I think they make Maxey drive into traffic and make him have to kick out more, be a little bit more creative when he gets into the paint and not just have to beat a smaller Josh Hart at the front of the rim. I think you're going to see a little bit more resistance from Maxey against Maxey in this game. But matching the Deuce minutes with Maxey, however, is going to be a big part of that. So again, you kind of want to do the same thing you did with Hartenstein. That I want to do with Hartenstein. You don't want to take Devo out of the game. When I say out of the game, out of his game, out of his rhythm, etc. He's been excellent for the team. And he does things that Deuce doesn't do, just like Deuce does things that he doesn't do. But if Deuce is going to be most effective when Maxey's in the game, then you want to match his minutes with Maxey. You don't necessarily want Deuce to just play when Maxey, or to play when Maxey's not on the floor, and then have to keep him in the game to play when Maxey is on the floor. Because then that means Devo doesn't get anything. And sometimes you need some of the stuff that Devo does. He's important to the team. All right, so give him an opportunity to get into rhythm and flow as well. And then in the second half, you go with the hot hand. Whoever's playing the best, that's who plays. They got to play a whole quarter, they got to play a whole quarter. I don't care about none of that, minute stuff. Play whoever you got to play as long as they need to play to win the game. And I trust Tibbs is going to do that. But at the end of the day, you lose this game, it's not the end of the world. But just know that you're looking at a long series. All you folks who think this is going to be easy breezy, you're definitely looking at a long series if you lose this game. We do have to talk about some of the fans and some of the things that they're doing. I don't care. I think it's fun. I think it's a tradition now that fans look forward to going outside on 7th Avenue and chant and jump up and down and act a fool. I do think there's some positives to that. I think it's a fun thing, but like most things, they have a downside. The downside is, one, they're going to chant as many different chants as they can come up with that everybody is going to get on board with. And sometimes that chant's going to be something stupid like F. Trae Young. Now, I'll be honest with you. I was at the games last year when they started doing that chant again. I thought it was funny because it was ironic. Now, it's like if we're doing this every year, it's old. It's like that Bing Bong thing. It's old. You got to wrap it up. All right? Trae Young is not in the playoffs. Trae Young got his own problems. You guys use these terms all the time about living rent-free in somebody's head. That's living rent-free in somebody's head. Enough with the Trae Young stuff. And then the burning Embiid jerseys. They did nonsense with Randall's picture last year. There's two things you got to understand. This is not just a Knicks fan thing. It's just there are so many Knicks fans, and Knicks fans do things and it goes viral. When they do stupid things in OKC, it doesn't go viral because nobody cares outside of OKC. Okay? Knicks fans, every time they do something, it goes viral. So now you live in a generation that likes to do things that they know will go viral. So you will see people do stupid things just to go viral. All right? As much as I talk about the fan narratives and how they influence the team, I don't want to hear people in the media use what you're seeing some fans do as a reason why the Knicks don't get credit and don't get positive looks from media members the way they should, the way they've deserved. Are you a child? Grow up. Okay? There's how many people here in New York? There are how many Knicks fans here? You're going to use something that goes viral on social media as an excuse for why people don't like the Knicks? Get a break. Give me a break. All right? You got fans in other markets that celebrate people getting injured. Get the hell out of my face. That nonsense. But yeah, if you're a Knicks fan listening to this, have fun. Go outside. Do your chants. Let's retire the Trae Young chant. We had enough of that. We got our own problems right now that don't involve Trae Young. Stop giving him all that oxygen. All right. Let's stop burning jerseys. Come on. But you can celebrate game ones all you want. And I hope you out there at this game too, celebrating this one too. At Sports Ethos on Twitter. At Ethos Knicks, Andre Gallagher. Oh wait, we didn't talk about how both Embiid and Maxey were listed as questionable for about 5 minutes, and then I looked it up. They were listed as game time decisions. Now we know Embiid has a knee. Maxey supposedly came up ill. They didn't say what the illness was. Got a little diarrhea. Got a little headache. I don't care. You know they're both playing. Nonsense that they're not playing. There's like a 2% chance they're not playing this game. If Maxey doesn't play this game, I can almost guarantee you that Embiid's not playing this game. But I was surprised that Nurse went as hard in game one as he did. I guess he felt like Embiid was healthy enough in that game, but now he only get one game off for game two. Again, I would not be shocked if they sat Embiid down in game two. But Maxey not playing? I don't believe it. I don't believe it. That's about as much air as I'm giving that story. Until next time.